Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
We're here with Tom, Alan, and Alan's colleague, Sarah Stromberg. I thought we'd all check in before getting started on the grapevine story. How's everyone doing?
I'm good. Cleaning house. I actually have the energy back to clean house. And that who would have thought I would see that as a great thing? But I'm feeling useful again.
Well, it does bring that home, though, doesn't it, Tom? That these little things we take for granted.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Automatically, man. And then all of a sudden they're gone. It's like, because of my hip restrictions with my hip, I can't bend over. And you don't realize how many times during the course of the day I bend over, pick up a sock or pick up a piece of paper on the floor. And now I'm so aware I'm not bending over.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder. It really does. Yeah.
When I had my injury recently, broke my arm and, you know, my knee and some other stuff, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about, they need to find more one-handed like versions of things, you know, because I would get so frustrated just having to jumble a bunch of different things at once. And something I never contemplated before getting injured, I just took that for granted, right? That I would have the full use of both halves of my body. But yeah, it does like awaken you a little bit to just all these little gifts that we, you know, we were walking around and just have no awareness of because we have not felt their absence.
Well, given the group that Sarah is joining today, I certainly hope she has a disability to discuss with us.
Sorry, I definitely am feeling really blessed today because Minnesota and it's like 50 some degrees. So we got to for a mile and a half walk with the dog. Yesterday, we got to go for a walk with my sister and her dog and the kids. So I'm definitely super grateful that I have all of my health and no injuries. And
we're grateful also. Very good.
I'll introduce Sarah to everybody because you guys don't know her. I've known Sarah now for probably right, Sarah? Quite fun. We met when I did my first or second workshop at Hazleton on emotional sobriety, and she attended all of the remaining ones I did for Hazleton, and as well as a lot of other workshops that we've done. She's a graduate of the Gestalt training group, that two-year program. She graduated that. She's a certified life coach, she's just an all-around amazing person. She's been on her own journey now for a number of years in recovery, and I'm one of your biggest fans, Sarah. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you, Alan. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. It's always good for, you know, us to bring somebody else in and to give another perspective and look at some of these issues around emotional sobriety. And, you know, as I told you going into this, what we've been doing here recently is, in one way, we're celebrating the fact that Grapevine has decided to, they devoted the whole January issue to articles on emotional sobriety. And it's the first time in the history of the Grapevine that they've done it, even though they've come out with a few publications. They've got two books collecting different articles on emotional sobriety, but it's the first time they've dedicated a whole Grapevine issue to that topic. And we've been for the last now 4 weeks, I think it's been, Patrick, or maybe this is week five. We've been reading one of the stories that people write in about and share their experience with emotional sobriety. And then we kind of add, if you know, see if we can sweeten the pot in terms of what that person said about emotional sobriety and bring in some of what we've been learning, you know, through this journey that we've all been on, that I've been on, that on Thursday night we've been on now for 4 years, Tom.
I know it. I know it. We were going to do it for a couple of months too, weren't we?
And it's 140 people from all over the world coming in and hanging out with us on Thursday evenings. And it's been wonderful. And I love the new format with you guys and our discussions and stuff. It's been great. What we're going to do today is we're reading the section called The Experiment. It's on page 28 in the Grapevine. If some of you, those that are listening, want to turn to the page, if you have that Grapevine, we're all going to read a couple paragraphs and then discuss it together.
As I look at the title, The Experiment, it has a deep resonance with me, just kind of even the header of the story, as somebody who did a fair amount of social, what's the term they use? It's like, you know, I'm getting out there and I'm trying to see if I'm truly an alcoholic.
Research, doing some research.
Social research, yeah. So we're going to hear about some social research. The experiment. To help with step one, they suggested she try some controlled drinking. So she did. Let's see how it went. No one likes to admit they have a problem. It took me years before I realized that I might have one with alcohol. It's funny looking back now because I can see so obviously all the consequences and issues that arose as a result of my drinking. All the hangovers, the unsafe situations I put myself into, the unhealthy relationships I stayed in, the fights I had, the excuses I made, the remorse I felt, the money I spent, and the mirrors I couldn't look into. There were so many signs that I had a problem, but I just couldn't see them. Besides, I hung out with people who drank like I did, and I dated guys who seemed to have a problem with alcohol, their consequences overshadowing my issues. So in my mind, I was just the same as everyone else. Besides, I owned a home and a car, and I had my career. I certainly couldn't have a drinking problem, could I?
In March of 2008, though, after getting a DUI, I decided to give up drinking for a while and, quote, take a break. It was harder than I thought. I had been in Al-Anon for several years, but decided to attend some open AA meetings. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just knew I didn't want to drink. Thank God for the people in those meetings who encouraged me to try to do some controlled drinking and see how I felt. Well, here's how it went. Night one. In April 2018, I had a work trip to Chicago. The first night of Friday, I went to dinner at a nice steakhouse and ordered a glass of white wine to go with my dinner. I decided that I would only drink half of the glass to show my control and prove I wasn't an alcoholic. Quickly, though, I realized as I was sipping that I had absolutely no idea where half was. I began an internal debate. If I had another sip, would that still be half? And what about one more sip? Just one more.
It sounds ridiculous to even say it out loud, but that was pure agony. I had to show my control, but I wanted to be able to drink as much as possible. It was quite the conundrum. And all the while, the person I was having dinner with had absolutely zero idea about the turmoil that was happening with me. There was literally a war raging inside my head. I finally settled on where half a glass of wine was, leaving some wine in the glass as we finished dinner and left the restaurant. It was hard, but I did it. Night two. We went out to dinner after Saturday to a crowded restaurant. I was tired from 2 days of working a trade show, long days on my feet, full of handshakes and conversations. Before we left the hotel, I had made up my mind that I was going to only have two beers at dinner.
By the time we had decided on a restaurant and elbowed our way through the crowded bar area to a table that was too small for our group of four, it was apparent to me that this whole idea of controlled drinking sucked, and I hated everyone and just wanted to get good and drunk. But no, I wouldn't do that. I said two beers, so that's what I would have. I can't remember what I ordered, but I recall they were ice cold and sweat dripped down the bottles, and I enjoyed every last drop. When the AA members told me about controlled drinking, they said to stop abruptly while drinking and see how I felt. Well, I can tell you that the moment I finished up my second beer, I was so mad, not just a little angry, livid. All I wanted was another beer. Two was definitely not enough. I didn't have another one, though. I had said two, so that's where it ended. It's funny looking back now, because I didn't even think I put it together that there was a correlation between my anger and controlling my drinking. At the time, I blamed my feelings on being tired, the crowded restaurant, the unfulfilling company, but it was definitely because I couldn't drink as much as I wanted.
Night three. Sunday was the final day of work in Chicago, and I was exhausted. Between the long hours working and the emotions of not drinking, or rather, not drinking the way I wanted to, all I wanted was an early night. What happened instead was the complete opposite. After dinner, my coworker and I decided to go to a bar to meet up with a few other salespeople. I have absolutely no memory of what I had at dinner to drink that night. I do know that I didn't set a limit for myself. After dinner, I was tired and didn't even feel like drinking anymore, but when we went to the bar, I ordered a beer, and then, you guessed it, another and another. And when the shots started coming my way, I didn't turn them down. I threw them back eagerly, relishing the relief they provided. Soon I was stumbling, blacking out, and passing out all in public. Eventually, I made it back to my hotel room.
Monday. The next morning, I woke up with what the Big Book calls a hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I felt all of those things. I had one of the worst hangovers I could remember. I'm a married man in my bed and a feeling of complete and utter hopelessness. For the first time in that entire weekend, I finally could see what those AA members had been talking about when they suggested I try to control my drinking. When I controlled my drinking, I didn't enjoy it. When I enjoyed my drinking, I couldn't control it. And it wasn't just me. I would later find a story in the back of the fourth edition of the Big Book, Crossing the River of Denial, where another member describes this exact same feeling.
It was an epiphany, albeit a painful one. And it was the beginning of the end of drinking for me. I had begun to take step one without knowing it, but I wasn't ready to give up just yet. It would still be months before I put down drinking for good, attempting several more times to control my drinking to prove that I didn't have a problem. But each time when I controlled my drinking, I was miserable. It's been over 13 years now since I gave up alcohol. And that weekend in Chicago was the beginning of the end of it all. I learned that there's no middle road for drinking for me. It's either all or nothing. I have found a wonderful fellowship in AA. We support each other, encourage each other, and lift each other up as we go. My gratitude for life, for the life I have today, is indescribable. There's no way I would be alive today had I not quit drinking.
On paper, I certainly didn't look like an alcoholic. It wasn't until I tried to stop that I realized I had a problem and that my life was actually unmanageable. If you think you might have a problem or you're just not sure, I encourage you to try some controlled drinking like I did. Try drinking and abruptly stop. See how you feel. Be honest with yourself. Only you can decide. And if you think it's time to stop, please know you don't have to do it alone.
I love this. Brings back some real memories.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
My first question to you is going to be, what's the connection with emotional sobriety? I know it's there, but I'm just not seeing it right up front.
Well, there's a lot of connections to it, but it has to be, we have to abstract to get them.
Wow.
First of all, we know that there's a paradox operating in all change. And the paradox is we're not going to be able to change something until we completely own what the reality is of what's going on. You know, this goes back to something we've said a lot about emotional sobriety. It's having an honest and appropriate, and you'll see how it applies here, an appropriate and honest relationship to reality. And so when I'm in denial of the fact that I'm an alcoholic and I keep trying to control something that I can't control, I can't have any emotional sobriety because I'm fighting reality. And when I fight, I fought the law and the law won, so to speak, right? That John Mellencamp thought. Mm-hmm. I fought reality, and reality is going to win every time. Reality is going to, knock the crap out of me when I go up against it. So that's the first thing that stands out in here, right? The second thing is that we talk about the centrality of acceptance and how important acceptance is in terms of emotional sobriety, which relates to accepting reality as it is, right? If I'm going to cope with it, I got to accept that this is what's going on first, right? And that's what's happening here. I mean, she's gotten to the point, but what she did, and it's brilliant, because what we say all the time is you don't know what's enough until you know what's more than enough. You've got to go with the resistance enough to get to the point of being able to get honest with yourself and for you to realize that I've been resisting the reality of my situation. So those are just a few things. I'll weigh in with a few others, but let's see what everybody else has to say.
Well, one of the things, first of all, it wasn't funny at the time when I was going through it, but reading somebody else's account of it, it does bring me to chuckle. because of the insanity that I had. And but I'm a good example of what you're talking about, Alan, because, and I, you know, and sometimes I forget that you know, there are people who are pursuing this road, this emotional sobriety or just good mental health, and have done an excellent job of stepping around and avoiding the fact that they have a problem with alcohol or drugs. Because, I mean, I always enjoy pointing out that when I was confronted with my alcoholism to the point where I quit drinking, I had been in the alcohol and drug treatment business for a long time. I was the clinical director of a program that I'd helped develop, an outpatient program for alcohol and drugs. It was a very successful program. I was good at what I did, and therefore, I couldn't be an alcoholic, or that wouldn't be possible. But absolutely, I used to have to convince myself that alcoholics, working with alcoholics, would drive you to drink, and that that somehow I was different from them. But it was like and I had made progress in my, I was in a lot of therapy, I'd made progress, but this was a block. This was a major roadblock that would, like what you're saying, Alan, until I faced it, there was only so much progress I was going to make.
Sarah, where do you come in on the story, first of all? Like what was going through your head when you were reading it?
I love that I got clean 20 years ago because there wasn't really the harm reduction, which would be NA's version or substance aversion of controlled drinking. So nobody suggested that I just cut back on my meth use. They're like, nope, you just need to stop. And so I really connected with the denial, because on paper, she's certainly not. She doesn't look, because she's got her home, she's got her career, she's got, and that's where I was when I got clean. I'm like, I still have my kids. I don't have any felonies. Like, I still have a roof over my head, my car, my job. But when you look at how she started, and she's like, the places that she was in and all of those, like, the real situations, it's not the surface or the external view. It's what's really going on inside. And when you stop to connect with how you're feeling and like not being able to look in the mirror, right? If that doesn't say that there's something that doesn't match or not your authentic self, then I don't know how else you could more clearly connect this to emotional sobriety. Like, it's very clear that she is just so caught up in the surface or the material things and not able to see the damage that this disease is doing in every other area of her life.
Well, that's such a good point, Sarah, because see, she's caught up in this image of who she thinks she has to be okay. I can't be an alcoholic to be okay. I've got to be someone that can control her drinking. And so she's going to, you know, pursue that delusion till the gates of insanity is in the second, right? And that's what she was doing. And despite all the evidence to the contrary, and I think that's the other thing, is that sometimes it takes just such a, what this Kuhn said, I can't remember, it's Thomas Kuhn. He was talking about the structure of scientific revolution. And what he talked about is that a paradigm has to get from such a crisis in science and all this evidence saying it's not true, it's not true. And such an overwhelming amount of evidence that it's not true before scientists are going to believe it. Well, we're not any different than those scientists. I mean, here we are with an awful lot of information to get to the point of realizing, you know what? This is something I'm unable to control. And I don't have that. That ability is just not a part of me. Now, it seems at face value, and I think this is another part of the emotional sobriety thing, Patrick. At face value, there's a lot of things that we think we're losing when we're giving them up, right? Like, she, for a long time, thought, if I have to give up alcohol, it really means something's wrong with me. But the truth is when I am in alignment with reality, I'm not losing something, I'm gaining something. I'm gaining the ability to appropriately cope with the situation that I'm confronting that's causing difficulties. But a lot of times we twist it around and make it like, oh my God, I got to give something up. I don't want to give this up. I'm going to lose something. You know, my life is going to be so bad now. If I can't drink and use, my God, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't think that I could survive sobriety. I feel like that was my mentality and my resistance to it. Because, I mean, it was a couple years, maybe like 2 to 4 years before I got some significant sober time, before where I knew that my goose was cooked and I would have to eventually make some radical changes. But I felt a little bit like, you know, in Gladiator, like, you know, I just get shoved out into the ring and like they put a little sword in my hand and, and I'm looking at the guy I have to fight. And then I'm like, I have to fight that guy, you know, and then that guy is recovery or that guy is sobriety. And like, you know, even though my addiction wasn't working for me, I just had the experience of moving through life in actual contact with feelings and, you know, doing the deal was so alien to my experience that like, I just couldn't summon the courage to do what I had to do until I lost quite a bit. And when I read the story, and I just felt so kind of inspired, and I thought that was an incredible amount of bravery and good sense when the woman said towards the end about how like, well, I am powerless, I've realized, and my life has become unmanageable. Even if she had all these kind of, she still had a fair amount of external kind of markers of having it all together. But like, I don't know, whenever anybody kind of can acknowledge that point, those points, you know, no matter what their station in life, I just always think it's like such a huge and wonderful leap of faith. And, you know, I when I met Alan, I was seeing a therapist, a different therapist who, I mean, to this day, you know, I'll let her know when I have a sobriety birthday, and just let her know I couldn't have gotten here without you. You know, just thank you so much for all the work we did together. But I was not ready to get sober at the time that I was, seeing her. Yeah. And then I would, it's funny because I would see Alan coming in and out of his office, and it was like an adjacent office from the person I was seeing. And he would just give me this very like benevolent, warm smile, like, hey, how's it going, buddy? You know, and you know, it's funny. It's almost like in this psychic realm, he was like the sober realm, you know, and I was in the, I was still in the madness kind of, you know, just trying to do it any other way. And so, but I, you know, even then I kind of had an inkling, you know what I mean? I needed to go into the Narnia of recovery, you know, just wasn't ready yet.
Well, first of all, I think that what you did know is that Alan would give you that benevolent smile and go in, and then he gave an evil laugh when he was on the other side of the door because he knew the plan. Yeah, soon he'll be in my grasp. But the thing I just thought about was there's a twist here that at the beginning of this story, this woman is demonstrating what I still include in emotional sobriety is honesty. I mean, we all know what, I mean, oh my God, just to let somebody know somebody who knows something about it, that you're questioning it is such a courageous act, you know? And I mean, and to go into be in meetings and talking to these people that honestly about that stuff. And, you know, even the honesty of sitting there and not just trying to be one of the, it's easy enough to go into AA and fake it and then go back out and drink. But it's like the idea is that's emotional sobriety. She's being honest. She's doing that. And it delivered her to a place of deeper, deeper honesty. But the coolest thing about it is what we could say to her is, wow, you really wanted, you know, whether you called it recovery or not, well, you wanted something more. You know, you didn't know that it was about being an alcoholic at that time, or you were hoping it wasn't. That was me. I kind of knew I was an alcoholic for a long damn time. But I was always hoping I wasn't, you know, I was always hoping there was a possibility that it would just turn out that that it would go away. But this woman was, and I was never that brave. I was never that honest to let somebody know until that. No, it took me, and my wife confronted herself and got into recovery. I always admire that. Do not understand that, because there's no way I would have ever gotten sober if she hadn't given me an ultimatum. Oh, I can't know that, but I don't think I would have.
Well, look,
it takes guts to even show up. I guess that's the short version.
Saying is sometimes that the people around us need to induce a crisis to wake us up. True, and it takes a big risk to do that, you know, for someone to be willing to confront us to that degree and draw a line. Mm-hmm. Say, look, I've had it with this. This things have to change. Mm-hmm. And if you get to that point, oftentimes things will change. I mean,
you know what gave me a chuckle in the story when she talks about the feeling of being mad when she hit that point of like one drink is too many and 1,000 is never enough. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that kind of just essential frustration that it's almost like in that little nexus point is alcoholism, basically. It's just like mm-hmm. realizing you're fucked either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to prove to yourself that you can control your drinking, you're probably an alcoholic. I mean, no, a social drinker doesn't go around thinking, hey, I wonder if I can control my drinking or not. It's not even a fine. We're the only ones. I remember this one radio that where Father Martin said that he was on. He said this guy called up at 2 a.m. and the guy's talking to him about whether he's drinking or not, whether he's an alcoholic or not because of his drinking. And Father Martin said the most obvious thing in the world to him. He said, listen, the fact that you're calling me up and asking me the question, you know, is telling me that you got a problem. In fact, all the things you told me, I'm gonna make this real simple for you. Let's replace the idea that you've done this with alcohol, that you've been doing it with green beans, that you're taking cans of green beans and hiding them in the toilet bowl, that you're opening up cans of green beans and going in your closet and eating them covertly so that nobody knows you're eating a can of green beans, that you're stashing green bean cans all around the house so you have plenty of green beans available for you. He says, it would be so obvious you got a problem if we were talking about green beans. But the problem is our society is so darn tolerant of our drinking because there's so much of it. It takes an awful lot for a person to break through that threshold and say and see that they've got a problem. But oftentimes we have a problem well before it becomes identified.
Yep.
I love that analogy. Think about it. If you were treating green beans that way, what would you think about your relationship to the green beans?
So Sarah, I suppose you told us that you yourself are in recovery.
Yes.
Was there like a moment when you kind of came into confrontation with reality or allowed yourself to accept reality that like you feel would be useful in the context of this conversation?
I definitely could relate to this story just because I really did say that I was not, I'm not an alcoholic, right? And mm-hmm. I can drink and I have, you know, countless stories of times that I drank like everyone else at the table, but you mm-hmm. put a bubble of meth in front of me and I'm off to the races and I probably won't come home for a few days. And so that whole like denial of this substance is different than this substance. And so it's that, are you willing to get honest and say, well, you know, I if I'm not using meth, what would my relationship look like with alcohol? And how right. would that shift or how would that change? And so like Tom, I had somebody that cared about me and threatened to, you know, mm-hmm. disrupt all of those material things that I had in place, call the parents, call the employer, call the landlord. And so I got scared. I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. shit. So I'm going to call my mom first and tell her, like, I have a problem. So mm-hmm. that was it. Like, that was my catalyst. But it was, again, years. I went to an outpatient treatment in 01. I didn't get clean until 03 because I kept thinking I can drink and it's okay. And I didn't mm-hmm. go back to meth for the first, like, 2 years. But then when I did go back, it was, you know, it was somebody from my home group that called and said, hey, we haven't seen you for 2 weeks. Are you okay? And then I came back to my home group. So, you know, like that, those little suggestions that I got from the beginning, because I was willing to listen to the people that had been there, saved my life. I believe firmly that, that's what got me back, was that phone call. That person's never called me before, never called me since. Just noticed that I missed 2 weeks in a row. So it's important for me to have that level of connection with people. And
You're also talking about the you know, I mean, we could do a whole podcast, a series of podcasts on denial, but all the different forms that denial takes. And it's like, you know, and for most of us, can point out a time in our lives, in our using lives, where we passed the threshold, you know, where basically we could just blatantly deny there was no problem at all. So then denial gets more, as what I always teach my clients, denial gets more sophisticated. You know, it's no longer blatant denial. It's rationalization. It's excuse making. It's a lot of storytelling and a lot of just excessive explanation about how this is different from that. Or not even from one drug to another, but it could also be from one situation to another. One of the stupidest ones, you know, I've done, is because of the different. I have problems with Jack Daniels, but not Jim Beam. You know, we really have a lot of experience before we get into recovery of going to any lengths. What I tell folks early in recovery is we have to be willing to go to any lengths, because the alcoholism doesn't even bat an eye at going to every length to do that. What I say is alcoholism one-on-one, any one of us going straight ahead with our addiction at this moment, no matter how long we've been clean and sober, if we go one-on-one without any outside help, no support available, we are going to lose. You know, Sarah, you and I are stronger and smarter than my addiction. We're stronger and smarter than your addiction, you know, but you by yourself with yours, me by myself with mine, you know, it's like you say, it's a matter of time. I drank so many times when I didn't have any consequences, and boy, I used that, you know, it's like, no, most of the time, you know, I'm fine. Yeah. But.
Well,
somebody say, you know, okay, so the times that you lose control, then you plan for it, right?
I was going to say, Sarah, I don't want to let this opportunity pass. You mentioned that it had been about 20 years since those days for you, and you're a Gestalt therapist. And I am currently pursuing my doctorate in not drinking and using drugs all day. I was curious about the levels. And, you know, this is kind of like what emotional sobriety means to me, is like, what are the isms beneath the addiction, you know, these unhealthy dependencies and, you know, these unenforceable rules. I'd imagine that if for no other reason than just the evolution of like kind of like your work and your career, like you've been kind of, I'm guessing you've been in touch with like, what were some of those things driving, you know, your addictive behavior, and like, what have you've learned about yourself in the last 20 years of recovery? I mean, I'd imagine there could be a podcast about that too.
Yeah. And I am not a Gestalt therapist. I went and did the training so I could be a better sponsor, because I saw what Alan could do in those retreats that I went to. And so
wow.
Everything that I have done has just been because this program has given me a life beyond my dreams. And so I wanted to be able to help other women find that for themselves. And so I've done a ton of work over the last two decades. And it's still like, I tell my home group all the time how sick I am, because my behaviors are still, I react and I'm hot or I'm cold, and it's like I'm extreme. And so right now it's really just learning how to think like Tom was just talking about, like, oh, you intended to do that. And it's like, no, mm-hmm. I was impulsive mm-hmm. and I just mm-hmm. reacted. And so now I've gotten myself clean in a place where I still can't look at myself in the mirror. And that mm-hmm. is, that was awful, right? Like mm-hmm. I didn't get clean to feel like a worthless piece of shit. I got clean to make my life better and be the person that I believe I was created to be. And so when I'm still acting out and reacting to life with and hurting myself and hurting others, that's not what I wanted to do. So I too like work with a professional to help me, you know, guide me through this, because it's not alone, never alone, never again. And every step, I just know that there's resources. Who can I go to help me with this? And who can I go to help me with that? And so it really is. It's like just taking it day by day. Just for today, I'm going to do the best I can to be here, be present, and show up. And when I can't, I know who I can call that can help me. Like, it's okay to lay down and just unplug today. You know, you can get up and try again tomorrow. It's okay. Like, not making myself, because I just keep it together. That's what one of my mentors would always say, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. And I've tried to keep it together for 40 plus years. And so now it's okay to just cry and not be like together. Like, I can just be me and be real and let the feelings finally be felt. And so it is.
Well, really though, keeping it together actually expands, and there's a different definition of it. We may use different language, but the truth is what we've learned is that that's okay. That's, you know, it's like the idea. I work with this all the time with folks, is where, you know, having feelings and even being, you know, stifled by your feelings, you know, is always seen as a problem. You know, this is a bad thing. It's like, no, it's not a bad thing. It's a thing. It happens to human beings. It's like, and no, knowing how to take care of that, you know, that's a big part of this stuff, about whether it be call it recovery or emotional sobriety. It's what you're talking about. You have confidence in yourself about being more resourceful about knowing how to take care of yourself in the moment. You don't have to predict every problem you're going to have and be ready for every problem. You begin to have confidence in yourself and your support system. No matter what happens, we can handle it. I feel that right here. It's just that's so helpful. Yeah. And I can tell you have that. Yeah. And also the idea that we'll never be finished, when we're all, you know, I always say, like, there would never be a time where I would go to a therapist and I would bore them ever. they would never be bored with me. There would always be plenty of things to do, you know, and I'm fine with that.
You sponsor people, Sarah?
Yes. Yes.
I'm sponsoring my first person right now, and it's really hard, and I feel like I'm bad at it. So what would you say are the what were you doing in your early sponsorship of people that you would later identified as like not being helpful? And like, what would be your advice to anybody just starting out sponsoring people?
Don't take it personally. You don't take credit for their accomplishments. So don't take the blame when they fall. Like, absolutely 100%. Perfect. And don't like, when I started sponsoring the first person that had more clean time than me, it was the greatest gift ever, because I wasn't afraid that she was going to relapse because she'd been doing this longer. So then I was just super direct. Like, you don't have to sugarcoat. We're not fragile. Like, we made it to recovery. We can handle the cold, hard truth. And so I really believe in just separating yourself and separating them from their disease. It's a lot of the gestalt stuff that Alan teaches. It's like, yes, part of you is this, but it's so important for you not to take the blame. And it's the suggestion. It's what they do with it. And I try to let them find their suggestion versus, and then I'll share my experience. So why don't, you know, you do this? Well, this is what happened when I did this. And so I think that is more, because then they're behind it and it's their idea, and really being smart about like specific, measurable, you know, like the coaching thing, like SMART goals. Like, we want to set them up for success. Start with their strengths. And that's kind of been, and then help them see, because I think we're blind to our own. So we don't see our patterns. And so as you see those things, being able to say that out loud, like, oh, I'm noticing, have you ever noticed that this is kind of a pattern? So, and you're there, you're already doing more than most of them had. So just pick up the phone and listen.
Sweeten the pot a bit on this one. Patrick, what do you think?
Oh yeah. I, I hope you come back, Sarah, because we've got a lot more to talk about and we won't be going anywhere.
If you want me back, you know, you guys need a little estrogen.
I think we do.
White guys talking. Oh, old white men. Of course, you're not old, though, but Patrick, but thank you for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.